Welcome to House of Comments. This week we've seen Sir Keir Starmer jet off to Davos and Rishi Sunak jet off to Blackpool. How times change. I'm Charlotte Henry and I'm joined by my co-host Emma Burnell. How are you, Emma?
I'm fine, Charlotte. How are you?
I'm good. We've got a lot to discuss this week. It really feels like the week, the year even, is really ramping up on the political front. But we need to start in Scotland. And this is a complicated and rather delicate issue, but it does need discussing, and it really dominated, quite legitimately, political discussion at the beginning of the week. And this is the issue of, the British government invoking what's called Section 35, which basically vetoes a piece of legislation coming from the Scottish Parliament. And the legislation they vetoed was a gender recognition reform.
Which, hold you up on the question of whether it's a veto.
Please do.
Essentially, the legislation, the government has had legal advice that says the legislation as written affects UK-wide legislation and as such cannot be passed because it would impact on UK-wide legislation. They essentially, Section 35, the first step is please go back to your parliament and rewrite the legislation in such a way that it doesn't do that. So it's not like as black and white as a veto.
Yes, it's been portrayed, hasn't it, as a bit of a nuclear option.
Yeah.
But of course, not only is the thing you're saying true, but also it can be challenged in court. This can go all the way to...
Almost certainly will be, because I suspect that rather than go back to the Scottish Parliament and try to rewrite this, Nicola Sturgeon will instead want to have yet another fight in the courts, which she feels would be more helpful to her.
Yes. And this is, we're talking about the Gender Recognition Reform Act. Have I got that name right?
I believe
Which had various impacts for trans people in Scotland and essentially changed the way and made it easier to get a gender recognition certificate, which says, I self-identify as a woman now, or self-identify as a man now, having been born the opposite sex.
Yeah.
And therefore, I am now recognised as this gender. Which is, you know, the couple of the biggest things in it, as I take it, is that it lowered the age you could get one of these certificates to 16.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's self-ID. It no longer requires a doctor to say, this has been going on, this person is suffering from gender dysphoria, et cetera, et cetera, and therefore should transition.
So it takes out any of the medical part of that. So you don't need a diagnosis of gender dysphoria to have a gender recognition certificate. And you only need to have lived in your acquired gender, which in itself is a complex topic, because many people would argue that it's very difficult to describe living in a gender without reverting to sex-based stereotypes. And that it's very hard to legislate for, but you have to have proved to have been living in your gender, your required gender, for 3 months rather than 2 years. So neither of the legislations dealt very well with that complexity of what living in a gender means. But the previous Gender Recognition Reform Act of 2004, I think it was, which was UK-wide, covered Scotland, said that you had to have a diagnosis of gender dysphoria and you had to have lived in your acquired gender for 2 years. This has made it, taken out that medicalisation, lowered the age at which you can receive one, and you only have to live in that acquired gender for 3 months. Those are the three sort of most contentious areas of it.
Yes. And I mean, the thing I wasn't particularly keen in some ways to discuss this, even though it was a huge story, just because I personally dislike whatever's one views, how kind of toxic the whole debate around this has become. But there is no doubt that what happened at the beginning of the week throws up so many different issues in so many areas. You've described the kind of, let's be blunt about it, the kind of different rights and conflicts of rights that something like this can flow up between women's rights and trans rights, and that there has to be, a reasonable debate to have some accommodation of both.
One of the problems, and I speak as someone who has spoken out on this issue, I know a lot of people don't. A lot of people are either they just don't want to get involved because it does, as you say, it's incredibly toxic. It's done me a great deal of professional and personal harm to speak out. I've been ostracized by people I previously considered as friends. But
just briefly outline, if you don't mind, the piece you wrote, just very briefly.
So I don't, as a essentially a second wave feminist, I'm an old school radical feminist, the really unfashionable kind. I don't believe in gender. Gender for me is a social construct that you can buy into or not buy into. And lots of people do. I recognize that in not recognizing gender as a construct I wish to live my life under, I'm in a minority. It's a very successful social construct, which lots of people do build their lives around. Most people who build their lives around it don't even really think about it. They just think this is what boys like, this is what girls like, this is who men are, this is who women are. That's how it always has been, always will be. Radical feminism challenged gender as a concept and said, you know, there, sex is real and immutable. Gender is social and constructed and should be challenged because it enforces a hierarchy between the sexes and the patriarchy. And I've always believed that, and it used to be fairly uncontentious in left-wing circles to do so. There are a few people, they're a small group, who feel radically disassociated from their body and the gender expectations that come with it. And they have probably always existed, certainly in our modern discourse. They've been around for, you know, a long time. This is not a new thing. And as such, they have long been a very marginalized group because, yeah, I mean, men dressing as women, whatever that means, have been the butt of jokes for millions and millions of years, you know, all through my life. Very, very progressive comedians would still laugh at a bloke in a dress. And I've always said that I admire people like, say, David Bowie, who wore a dress on the cover of his one of his albums in the 70s, while still maintaining that he was a guy. And of course he is. You know, putting on a dress does not make you a woman, as far as I am concerned. But if you feel very, very strongly that you want to live as the sex that you are not, most of the time, I would have absolutely no problem with that. Where there are issues are that there are predatory men in the world who are men, who will abuse the spaces where we loosen safeguards. And I, you know, and that means that we do have to protect. And in all of the Gender Recognition and Equality Act legislation that has been passed so far, there has been a recognition that sex segregated spaces mean sex segregated, not gender segregated. And where this bill has been most contentious is that just before the legislation was passed, there was a court case that said that, according to the Equalities Act, a gender recognition,
which again is UK-wide,
which is UK-wide, a gender recognition certificate would, to all intents and purposes, change your sex legally. So you would be legally recognised as the opposite sex. And that means that you would have access to areas that have been reserved for sex segregation under the Equalities Act. So therefore, making getting a gender recognition certificate much, much easier allows people to abuse that ability who are not necessarily trans. And this is not one of the toxic things that always happens is people turn around to people like me and say, you're saying all trans people are perverts trying to get into women's spaces. And we're saying, no, it's like the old phrase, we know not all men are rapists, we just don't know which men are. I 100% know that not all trans people are abusers. I just don't know which people now, under self-identity, calling themselves trans, might be abusing the system. And that's the problem of the legislation. And that's where the feminist argument that has been widely ignored in favour of a conservatives versus progressive trans rights fight has happened in this culture war.
For me, what I was deeply concerned about during the debate around this piece of legislation is there was, in some quarters, an attempt to portray it as basically an administrative tidy up.
Mm. Which it isn't. It just isn't.
You know, when I looked into it, I don't feel it is. Now, there is a perfectly legitimate argument that some activists can make that that's great, that yeah. That this is an overhaul that improves the lives of trans people and should do, and that is a great, great thing. People can legitimately make that argument. But I would like us to discuss legislation like this, acknowledging the significance it has.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. There may well be people who would push back on me to say that what I'm saying about male-bodied people in single-sex spaces, women's reserve single-sex spaces, is either a price that's worth paying for the improved rights of trans people, or simply won't happen, and that I'm scaremongering. And that's an argument we should be having, but it's a separate argument from saying this is just about birth certificates and marriage certificates, because it's just not the case.
No, I from what I have read and looked into about this, I don't believe it is just about administration. Obviously, in some, you know, it will have an administrative effect, and it will make the lives, you know, will make that transition administratively easier. Again, people can legitimately put the case that that is a good thing. And I'm happy to, you know, I'm happy for a proper debate about it. I always am on these, you know, important discussions. We should have that. But I'd like across the board for there to be honesty about the discussion. Yeah,
absolutely.
And it concerns me when people, and I also don't understand, actually, if you're, an advocate who thinks this is a great piece of legislation, which, again, a perfectly legitimate position to hold, I don't understand why you would like to downplay it. Politically, you can make it a huge success. So I don't really understand that. There's another thing about, you know, this process, which it came to a head this week, but has been going on for a while, the discussion around this piece of legislation, that makes me deeply, deeply uncomfortable. And that I cannot shake the feeling that Nicola Sturgeon is using trans people. I'm going to be really blunt about it. I think Nicola Sturgeon is using trans people as a political football. And frankly, trans people, who you have quite rightly articulated, are a very, very small minority who have had a very difficult time and have been very publicly mocked for a number of years. Frankly, they deserve better than being used by Nicola Sturgeon to inflame a fight to try and get her ultimate aim of Scottish independence.
Yeah, I completely agree.
As you said, she knew, because of the Equality Act that exists, that this would be a clash. She knew that it was very likely the Conservative government would have to, for the first time, trigger Article 35.
Yeah.
And
Section 35. You've gone too Brexit there.
I did go a bit Brexit, which is never a good thing. And she knew that this would likely happen. And frankly, I don't think he's disappointed that it has.
No. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon is not an idiot.
No, of all the things she is, she's a very savvy political operator.
Savvy political operator. Now, it feels at the moment like she might be a political operator who feels she's running out of time. For two reasons. First of all, she's been in charge for a really, really long time. Her party are more restive than they've ever been under her, which is, to be fair, not even that restive, but, you know.
Yeah, they can do a... They're almost as good as the Conservatives about having an internal bust-up.
But they are... and she wants a fight with a Tory government.
Correct.
In Scotland... While there is a significant portion of voters who do vote Conservative and are on the right,
or traditionally has been it's sort of dissipated over the years, but there was a very distinct strain of Scottish conservatism.
Yeah, absolutely. But it has tended to sit to the left of the rest of the UK.
Indeed.
and has often felt very removed from a UK parliament that is dominated by English seats, because that's where the majority of the population mm-hmm. live, and those English seats who vote Conservative. So if, as the polls suggest, we're likely to get a change in government, that will be harmful for Nicola Sturgeon's, the urgency of her case for independence. She'll still be making it, obviously, that's her job. But Scott's loathing of the Conservatives, and particularly this current flavour of Conservatives, will be significantly more helpful to the case for independence than a mild-mannered Labour government.
I think that's absolutely right. So she thinks she's basically got a year or so to make...
So this was the fight that she could pick in that time, essentially.
Yeah, and I...
Which, as you say, is very, very cynical in its use of a small marginalised community in the trans community and the rights of women.
A couple of other things to point out. I should point out that in the Scottish Parliament, there was actually support from all parties for, yes, for the legislation. There was divides within parties, but MSPs across the board did vote for it, and it did pass with a pretty significant margin. I can't remember the numbers, but it was pretty significant.
It had the biggest rebellion of Scots Nats MSPs that they'd ever had, and the first ever resignation from one of her cabinets. But yes, all parties supported it. All parties had their rebels. But yes, or rather, I think on the Conservative side, their rebels supported it. But either way, there were MSPs of both of both voting both ways in each party.
Yeah. The other thing is UK-wide, Sir Keir Starmer has actually raised concerns about. So this is not a kind of Tories stopping one thing, Labour's saying another. Like Sir Keir Starmer raised some concerns about it as well.
Yeah, and Labour abstained on the, I mean, it wasn't even a vote on whether to invoke Section 35. It was a vote on whether they debated raising Section 35, which is a weird thing to abstain on, frankly, because if anyone was watching the telly, you'd go, well, yeah, they did just debate.
Yeah, because there was discussion in the House, wasn't there? In the House of Commons, there was a very passionate discussion from people, again, who believe in, wanted to pass legislation.
And yeah, it was but they did, you know, they what they didn't do was vote the other way. I think 11, only 11 Labour MPs rebelled against the whip to abstain. Keir Starmer would love for this all to go away, frankly. If he never has to say penis ever again, I think he'll be a very, very happy man. But he has started shifting his emphasis in discussions around this area, recognizing the complexities, which I think is probably to be welcomed by anyone who wants to see the debate taken the heat out and added a bit more light.
And I think the other UK-wide issue was there was some discussion, and I don't know how accurate this is, but it's a thing to be aware of, is that there was a bit of a discussion that people who wanted to transition could go to Scotland and do so under this more simplified process and then use the gender recognition certificate UK-wide. Again, that might be something you think is fantastic. You know, I'm not comparing the two directly, but we know there are stories, for example, of when abortion restrictions in Northern Ireland were more difficult, people came to the rest of the UK. Women came to the rest of the UK in order to go through that more, more comfortably. And so, again, it's something to be aware of when we're looking at the whole implications of what happened in Scotland. And that's why I return to my main point, actually, that I want this discussion to be had in an honest way where we're really discussing the implications of it. And I do also think... Look, I am a unionist. I would like the union to stay together. And I think in something as important as this, the decision should be union-wide. I know huge amounts are suddenly delegated, have over time been delegated and passed over to the Scottish Parliament. But this, to me, feels like the type of thing that there really should be UK-wide agreement on?
Well, it would have been perfectly possible to draft this legislation in such a way that it didn't impact on the Equalities Act. If they'd accepted some of the amendments that Labour put forward, that would have helped a lot. But that wouldn't have done.
You mean the Labour MSPs?
Labour MSPs, yeah. They put forward amendments on the age limits and on protecting segregated space, particularly prisons, which is a huge concern. But those amendments failed. This legislation, if it were just the tidying up exercise it's being sold as, could have been written in such a way that didn't impact on the Equalities Act. Because what's happened, your legislation doesn't exist in a vacuum. It never does. And it impacts on other pieces of work. And you have to be cognizant of that. And this is poorly drafted legislation that has those impacts. And as such, you cannot, as a smaller parliament representing a smaller population, impose the impacts of your legislation on the rest of the country without a debate, without a legal process.
Which brings me back to my point that, frankly, I think Nicola Sturgeon was just in many ways looking for a fight.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's got one. That she's chosen to have it on an issue that is actually less popular in Scotland than most of the other issues she could have chosen. This legislation is not popular in polling in Scotland. But again, I come back to that desperation, that timing problem that she's got.
The other point I want to make, which is exactly linked to what you're saying about Nicola Sturgeon sort of running out of time, perhaps, is it all leaves me with the question, I've had this question for quite a long time, as support for the SNP has grown as they basically become the dominant force, political force in Scotland, both that transfers down to Westminster and, of course, in the Scottish Parliament, where they became, let's not underestimate this, they won a majority in the Scottish Parliament. And that was a system that was designed never to have a majority. And they managed to dominate so greatly that they got a majority. And it leaves me with the question, are the Conservative and Unionist Party going to oversee the end of the union?
I mean, that is the question, isn't it? If by some statistically unlikely chance the Tories win the next election, then yeah, I think they could well be. I'm not sure that there is enough legislative and legal process time between now and the next election for us to get to the point where Scotland could hold a referendum and would hold a referendum and that the SNP would win it.
Yep. The UK government has made it very clear it will not sanction another legal and binding referendum. The Nicola Sturgeon has therefore said that the next general election is a de facto referendum.
Which you can't do. I mean, it's just a nonsense. The idea that you can tell everyone in Scotland what's in their heart when they go and tick their box is ridiculous.
Ridiculous. And also, frankly, who cares if she decides it is? It's not a legal and binding referendum. She can say all she likes. This is a de facto referendum on the future of Scotland. And whoever wins the next election can go in, you know, the UK-wide election, whoever's the Prime Minister, whoever's the Scottish Secretary can go, oh, that's nice for you.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's kind of dumb because, as I say, Labour were unelectable in 2019. They're not now. And that was true in Scotland as it is in England. So they may well increase their vote share. And they are a unionist party. Now, OK, that will largely be to the detriment of the Tories, but it won't be completely to the detriment of the Tories. There'll be plenty of people who voted Scots Nats because they wanted to vote for a leftish party, a seemingly progressive party, who weren't led by Jeremy Corbyn.
I think that's a perfectly coherent argument. I think that almost certainly happened in some places in Scotland. They didn't want to vote Conservative. They didn't want to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, so they voted Scottish Nationalist.
It might well be that the SNP's vote share goes down at the next election.
And also, we should remember, and we see this, we've discussed this in terms of the Conservatives on previous shows, but it can also be true of the Scottish Nationalist Party. They've been in power a long time.
And they've not done very well. They've not you know, they've not done great with it.
People can go, why am I voting for this lot again?
Health attainment, all of those measures that a normal government would be seen by, a government that wasn't single issue obsessed would be measured by, they're falling down on really badly. Drug deaths in Scotland are a scandal.
And have, you know, there are lots of things that have not been improved for a long time. You know, I know you're a big theatre buff, and I saw images. I love stand-up comedy, and we both saw the images, for example, coming out of the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, where there was
a clash with the government, with the, you know, with councils and the government and whatever else, that led to rubbish in the streets. You know, it's a small example that, you know, all is not well in SNP land.
Yeah, exactly. But for the moment, because all conversations lead back to independence or not, so much of this gets swept under the carpet.
I think that's right. And it's been fascinating this week to see these two very important issues kind of meld together. The issue of balancing trans rights and women's rights, and the issue of Scottish independence, have kind of all moulded together over one piece of legislation. It's been, as I say, it's been quite, in some ways, tough and quite very emotive in many ways, debate to watch. And I hope...
absolutely. And I think that's true for everybody. Whatever side you fall onto on the debate, most of us start from the position of not wanting to harm other people. However much we're painted the other way, it's not about being a bigot, whether that's anti-trans or anti-women. It is about simply trying, really, really trying to fight for the rights of a group that you're particularly in affinity with in a way that does the least harm to any other group. And that's what we all need to get back to.
And you know, and trying to have a civilised debate and trying to have a civilised society where everyone, you know, feels, frankly, the word is safe, isn't it? Yeah. We're safe. Anyway, I suspect this is not the last. Well, we know for a fact this will not be the last we hear about these issues. Talking of safety, you and I are both women in London who have lived basically our whole lives in London. And that means for all of our lives, we've been policed by the Metropolitan Police. And once again this week, we have heard... I can't even find the words to articulate how angry I am about this. I thought I couldn't get angrier than seeing those images of hearing the Sarah Everard story and seeing those images of the protest and female protesters being hauled away by the police force they were protesting against after one of their own had murdered a woman. But frankly, the case of David Carrick, who admitted to close to 50 offences, I think it was 48 offences, has made me so seething. And the this doesn't end. There's a story on the BBC website, I think it came out the day before we're recording this, on the Thursday. The headline is Met Police Officers Investigated After Strip Search of Girl 15. There were stories about, again, offences committed by former Metropolitan Police officers. This just goes on and on and on. And the only conclusion I can come to is that the Metropolitan Police, which, let's be clear, not only is it London, one of London's police forces, because we also have the City of London Police for the square mile, but it, on many issues, is the national police force. And it is, frankly, no longer fit for purpose.
If it ever was.
If it ever was.
What we know from these story of Carrick is that he was vetted and vetted and vetted.
Vetted so much, he was able to work in Parliament.
Yeah.
Lindsay Hall had to send a letter to members of Parliament once he pleaded guilty and the reporting restrictions were lifted, outlining his concern that someone like this had been able to work in Parliament.
Yeah. He was also, as well as going through formal vetting and them going, nothing to see here, over and over again, his nickname was Bastard Dave, We are talking about a culture that knew exactly who this guy was, but they might have known exactly what he was doing, but they knew exactly who he was. And he was not only welcomed in their ranks, he rose through them.
Yeah, as I say, I'm almost too angry to find words to continue this, which is not particularly useful on an audio podcast, but that's how it's how I feel about it.
And I think, I mean, we need to look at two things. First of all, I think the structure of the Met needs to completely change.
In terms of it being both a national and London police force?
Yes, I would take out the national stuff. I would devolve the London-wide to overlapping, potentially, borough-wide police forces so that people can work. I mean, the problem with that, the immediate problem is that if you commit a crime in Cramden and run away to Islington, like, will they be able to share information properly? Because that's, you know, reasonably easy to do. But I think that would also be true if you commit a crime in Enfield and run away to Hertfordshire. And, you know, that hasn't stopped us having structures that have two separate police forces there. So let's not over egg the pudding of how difficult that would be. But also, we need to think really, really consciously in this country about what is a crime, what is cultural, and how do we do those two things separately and differently? Because I think at the moment we're asking our police to do way too many things, and they're doing nearly all of them badly. So we've got a rape conviction rate of 1%. But we've also got, you know, only I think that similar level of percentage actually ever goes to charge.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so contemptible.
Yeah, we have essentially legalized rape. The same is true. Like, the only reason anyone reports a burglary these days is to get your crime number for the insurance.
Yeah, I mean, I have personal experience of this low-level crime. I've had a bike stolen twice, and essentially in London, bike theft is legal.
Yeah. Only reason you would ever think about telling anyone else about it is to get that, as I say, to get that number.
Yeah.
So that you could get your insurance. We don't expect it ever to be solved.
Correct. Ever.
And then we also have the police doing a number of things that should be picked up elsewhere. For example, policing tweets, going and knocking on people's doors to tell them they've been a bit mean to someone on Twitter.
This is, Emma, this is quite liberal of you. But yeah, basically,
I'm not liberal, just because I'm also a socialist.
But also, yeah, I mean, do we really need the police knocking on the door because you've said something a bit mean? Unless you're making a direct threat to someone, which obviously is a whole different level of thing. Yes, I'm obviously inclined to agree with you.
And then also, they are picking up the slack where so many other services are lacking, in particular services around social services and mental health services. And so police are coming in at moments of crisis and taking people out of situations because there's nobody else to do that. And that's a real problem as well. So again, it's about this sort of absolute rundown. So that, I think, is not the police's fault. But a lot of their resource is being used on things that should have been intervened in far earlier. And if we had a working state, they would have been.
And people might be wondering why we're discussing this on a set of Sensibly Politics podcast. But of course, this does all come back to politics. Now, First of all, people might agree or disagree with the point you've made. But there's another point here. There's two very senior politicians that need to sort this out. One is the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who... Okay, I thought eventually he did do well dealing with the previous Met Commissioner, Cressida Dick. It took a bit of time, but he really did lose his patience and temper and put his foot down on that. And the other, of course, is Home Secretary Suella Braverman. And they may be from different parties, who obviously has to deal with the national implications of the Metropolitan Police. And they may be from different parties, but they are going to have to work together to sort this out because this cannot go on.
No, absolutely it can't. And I think it's really disappointing and very poor timing on the government's behalf to be pushing anti-protest legislation.
Oh, yes. I wondered if we were going to...
In this week.
Yes.
You know, that's what they need. More things they can do badly and more ways to tell people protesting against them that they can't.
Well, again, this slightly reminds me of the server Erevarad, absolute horrors, because, OK, that was lockdown legislation. Which really was the problem there. It was the problem. It was the legislation that was used against both Sarah Everard by Wayne Cousins to get her.
Yeah.
And it was also what was used to move the protesters on in that disgusting manner. So, I mean, as I said, this is going to have to be dealt with by two very senior politicians, and it needs to be dealt with quickly, because I think, I mean, frankly, women of London have long ago given up with the being able to trust the Metropolitan Police and feeling safe by them. And it has to be dealt with. That's a rather miserable way to end the show, but I'm really pleased we got to cover it, because first of all, yes, you and I might be Londoners, but it's not a London-centric issue.
Also, it's okay to talk about London sometimes.
And sometimes it is okay. Yes, let's level up the Metropolitan Police.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Or just level them.
On that note, Emma, where can people keep up with you?
I'm on Twitter at EmmaBurnell_, and I'm on my Substack, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter and at theaddition.substack.com as well. Emma pointed out last week, we have a fully functioning Twitter account, and we'd love to hear from you on it. So please do message us at HOC Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. There's also a Facebook page. If you look for House of Comments on Facebook, you can tell us why we're right or wrong over there as well. And also suggest things you'd like us to discuss. We love hearing from you. You can listen to the show, as you know, anywhere you get your podcasts. Please share it and tell friends and help us grow and help us, you know, help us beat Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell. Come on, let's do it. We've got, you know,
the girls.
Yeah, exactly. So help us get up those podcast ratings. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.